Russia bombs Ukraine ports for a third straight night after pulling out of a crucial grain export deal.
All this wheat here behind me, we will lose. It's a pity, but if we can't export it, we can't eat it all ourselves. So Black Sea is really the only option to get this stuff out.
Plus, mounting U.S. concerns over an American soldier who dashed into North Korea 2 days ago as Pyongyang remains silent.
This is not a country that is known for humane treatment.
And Zambia's national women's football team will make its World Cup debut Saturday against Japan at the games in Australia and New Zealand. Today is Friday, July 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. Dozens were injured after a third night of Russian air attacks pounded Ukrainian southern cities, including the port of Odessa and Mykolaiv, a town close to the Black Sea. Russia's attacks on southern Ukraine intensified this week after President Vladimir Putin pulled Russia out of a wartime deal that allowed Ukraine to safely export grain from Black Sea ports to countries facing the threat of hunger. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell spoke with White House National Security Spokesman John Kirby about the latest developments.
Is the administration looking at any workarounds to get these essential supplies out of the port? Things like NATO escorts or reflagging vessels? And then how seriously does the administration take the threat from Russia's MOD that it's going to treat all vessels in that port as carrying military equipment?
Well, we have to take that ridiculous threat seriously. I shouldn't say it's not ridiculous. We have to take it seriously. And we will. We are working and we will work with Ukraine and our allies and partners to try to find other ways to get the grain out of Ukraine. It'll most likely have to go through ground routes. We've done this before. We did it before the grain deal was in effect. It's not as efficient. You can't get as much grain out that way. We understand that, but we're going to keep trying. I mean, look, what has to happen here is, aside from Russia ending its blockade, and make no mistake, that's what they're threatening to do, is a military blockade. That is a military act. Aside from just not doing that, they need to get back into the deal. The deal was good for everybody, including Russian farmers. But it was really good for developing nations who have food scarcity issues that are only going to be exacerbated by this throughout the global South, Asia, Africa, Latin America.
Putin has said, the Kremlin has said he's not going to South Africa, which allows him to avoid getting arrested. Does the U.S. still encourage ICC signatories to arrest him if they have the opportunity?
We believe it's important that everyone responsible for the atrocities and war crimes in Ukraine to be held accountable. And that includes Russian leaders who are responsible for the efforts of their troops on the ground in Ukraine.
The foreign ministers of Ukraine and Pakistan on Thursday called for restoration of the Black Sea Grain Initiative to ensure global food security. Meanwhile, Russia's move on Monday has caused global grain prices to surge just as Ukrainian farmers are harvesting wheat crops. Anna Kostuchenko spoke with Ukrainian farmers about how this will affect them.
With 3 decades of farming experience, Ruslan Holub has cultivated valuable connections with prominent global traders. And even before Russia pulled out of a deal to allow Ukrainian grain shipments from Black Sea ports, he says Moscow purposely tried to delay those shipments.
I have spoken to many traders, and all of them said that Russian inspectors only created unnecessary queues. Many ships were simply on hold.
Ukraine has been working to establish new routes along the Danube River and land routes through Slovakia and Poland. But Holub says so far the Black Sea route remains the best.
The sea lets us save on logistics. This affects the on-site production cost for farmers.
Dutch farmer Kees Huizinga has been working in Ukraine for over 2 decades. He worries that he will lose his entire harvest if he cannot ship through the Black Sea routes.
All this wheat here behind me, we will lose. It's a pity, but if we can't export it, we can't eat it all ourselves. So Black Sea is really the only option to get this stuff out.
This year, Ukrainian farmers have seen a significant drop in grain prices. Holub says he and other farmers are selling their harvest for about $150 per ton, half the price of 2022.
Currently, we are on the verge of zero earnings or even losses. How can this be? Ukrainian farmers are hardworking by nature, and they understand we will eventually return to the levels of income we once had. But it is essential to continue planting despite the current challenges.
Ukrainians are counting on international partners like Turkey and the UN to ensure their grain exports on the Black Sea. Pavlo Lakichuk is from the Center for Global Studies.
If necessary, under the auspices of the UN, Turkey can ensure the security of the grain corridor without Russia. The essence of this proposal lies in the fact that ships moving towards our ports and in the Black Sea Straits fly various flags from Togo to Turkey. Therefore, any attack by Russia on any ship would be considered an act of piracy.
After withdrawing from the grain deal, Russia started shelling Ukrainian grain storage facilities. President Zelensky says bolstering air defense system at Ukrainian ports like Odessa could help mitigate threats and maintain stable global food prices. Anna Kostyuchenko for VOA News, Kyiv region, Ukraine.
The U.S. says North Korea has said nothing about the American soldier who bolted across the border from South Korea earlier this week. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The Biden administration says it has tried to discuss Private Travis King with zero success.
Unfortunately, no.
Pentagon spokeswoman Sabrina Singh says that leaves a lot of unknowns about the 23-year-old's status.
We don't know his condition. We don't know where he's being held. We don't know the status of his health.
It's the not knowing that is deeply concerning to us.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby was asked if the U.S. is worried North Korea may torture King.
This is not a country that is known for humane treatment.
For now, a U.S. official says King is listed as AWOL, away without leave. He has not been declared a deserter, a far more serious offense that, in times of war, can carry the death penalty. Sagar Magani, Washington.
U.S. Special Presidential Envoy for Climate John Kerry and his team met with their Chinese counterparts in Beijing this week. VOA's Laurel Bowman reports that the meetings were short on specifics and drew mixed reviews from close watchers of the climate talks.
U.S. Climate Envoy John Kerry said the threat of global warming requires global leadership, including from the world's top two polluters, the United States and China.
The climate issue is not a bilateral issue in our judgment. President Biden believes, as I think most of the world does, that the climate crisis is a universal threat to humankind. And we all have a responsibility to deal with it as rapidly as we can. And we hope we will leave other issues to the side.
Chinese officials made some hopeful comments during Kerry's visit, but China's top leadership said Wednesday that the country would move at its own pace to protect the environment. The nation has a way to go, some experts say. Tom Woodroof is the founding director of the Asia Society's China Climate Hub.
In the last year, a lot of China's action has actually gone backwards. We've seen their emissions go up the highest in any single year period. We've seen coal power plant approvals go up. We've seen the domestic consumption of coal go up.
Climate talks between the U.S. and China had been stalled for roughly a year because of national security, technology, and ideology issues. So the re-engagement between the two countries is in itself an important step, some experts say. Nathan Holtman directs the Center for Global Sustainability at the University of Maryland.
That is a step that could produce potentially enhanced action in each of the two countries, and also a step that will potentially support enhanced action globally, as the world's two biggest economies and two biggest emitters need to be coordinating and communicating.
Holtman says the U.S. and China are wrestling with questions about developing renewable energy, deploying electric vehicle fleets, and curbing the emission of gases such as methane. But other experts were watching for news of concrete agreements. Daniel Kamen is a professor of energy at the University of California, Berkeley.
What they had in China was really a clearing of the air, a display and a discussion of what's working and what's not working. No agreement came out of this, I think largely because there is this very large backlog of issues.
Again, Tom Woodroof of the Asia Society.
I think this is a small win for the US-China relationship as a whole and the stabilization of that relationship. But I think on climate change especially, any significant breakthrough has really been punted down the road.
Further talks are reportedly planned between the US and China before the COP28 climate talks this year in Dubai. Laurel Berman, VOA News, Washington.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Iraq expelled the Swedish ambassador on Thursday in protest of a planned burning of the Quran in Stockholm that prompted hundreds of protesters to storm the Swedish embassy in the Iraqi capital. The U.S. military command in Africa said in a press statement Thursday that it conducted an airstrike in central Somalia that killed five al-Shabaab militants. Twin suicide bombings targeting a government compound in northwestern Pakistan killed at least three police officers and wounded 10 others Thursday in a volatile district bordering Afghanistan. And Indonesian authorities have arrested 12 people, including a policeman and an immigration officer, accused of trafficking 122 people to Cambodia to sell their kidneys. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Astronomers at the European Southern Observatory say they may have spotted two exoplanets sharing the same orbit around its star, located about 370 light years away. There are many celestial objects, such as asteroids and moons, that share the same orbit in our solar system. Using the ELMA radio telescope array, the scientists noticed a patch of debris that might be following an exoplanet twice the size of Jupiter called PDS-70b. The astronomers say this debris cloud could either be material that will form a new planet or the remains of one that already formed. While theorized by scientists years ago, this discovery may provide the first piece of evidence that planets can share the same orbit. The astronomers will check in on these possible co-orbiting planets again in 2026. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Israeli President Isaac Herzog used his U.S. visit this week to ease tensions with Israel's longtime supporters in Washington with the policies of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which some say are extremist, have come under fire. For VOA, Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
From the multiple standing ovations during Israeli President Isaac Herzog's speech to the U.S. Congress, it looked like the U.S.-Israel relationship is stronger than ever. But Herzog could not ignore the tensions that overshadowed the trip.
I'm not oblivious to criticism among friends, including some expressed by respected members of this House. I respect criticism, especially from friends, although one does not always have to accept it.
In his White House meeting with Herzog, President Biden stressed his deep connection to the Jewish state, calling the bond unbreakable. But the very fact that it was Israel's president, a symbolic figure and not the actual leader of the government, Prime Minister Netanyahu, who was invited to the White House and to speak before Congress, reveals the deep tensions between the U.S. and the current Israeli government. Only the day before Herzog's visit and 7 months after Netanyahu came back into power did President Biden invite Netanyahu to meet at an unspecified time and place. Nimrod Novick is a former security official and member of the Israel Policy Forum.
In Israel, a prime minister is not a prime minister until he visits the White House. Traditionally, this used to happen within weeks of one's swearing in to the position.
President Biden has warned Netanyahu about undermining Israeli democracy by pursuing a radical reform of Israel's judicial system without broad public consensus and in the face of widespread protests. Biden has also voiced concerns about extremists in Netanyahu's governing coalition. Michael Oren was Israel's ambassador to the U.S. during President Obama's tenure.
The presenting problem in the relationship here is the reform, but I think there are much deeper problems. The much deeper problems relate to this government's position toward the Palestinians, toward the two-state solution that the United States still upholds, and the presence of ministers like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who are utterly unacceptable to this administration. I don't think acceptable to any administration.
Throughout his visit, President Herzog tried to reassure American leaders that Israeli democracy remains strong, even if it is currently in turmoil. Whether this will be enough to bridge the significant gaps between the Biden and Netanyahu government policies remains a question. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The restoration of diplomatic relations between Turkey and Egypt in early July is raising hopes for ending conflicts across the Middle East and Africa. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Turkey and Egypt have both been involved in civil wars in Ethiopia and Libya. And analysts hope the recent restoration of full diplomatic ties between Cairo and Ankara will help ease tensions across the Middle East and Africa regions. Libyan security analyst Aya Bouwella.
It could affect, for Egypt at least, their issue they have in Ethiopia, because both countries support different sides of the conflict. So in general, I think this is good. I think it's helpful for Libya as well, because both sides support different factions in Libya. And I think the stalemate has gone on for such a long time. It's about time that the existing powers figure out something that everybody can agree on.
Turkey's military intervention in support of Libya's government of national accord against Egyptian-backed forces of General Khalifa Haftar brought Turkey and Egypt to the brink of a direct confrontation. Now, Ankara says economic cooperation offers a way forward. Mesut Jarshan is a presidential advisor at Istanbul's Yeditepe University.
When licking the tension time, almost the Turkey and Egyptian army come together face to face here. However, Turkey and Egyptian, first of all, maybe bring energy security and energy the trade. Secondly, when if they come together in the Libya, it should be beneficial both Turkey and the Libya.
But the Turkish military presence in Libya remains an obstacle, with Cairo calling for its removal. That is the warning from security analyst Aya Bouwella.
Egypt wants to see concrete actions. They want to see withdrawal of troops in Libya, the withdrawal of Syrian mercenaries in Libya. Egypt has a red line in Libya.
Libya's vast energy wealth offers a powerful impetus for cooperation between Turkey and Egypt. Jalel Hajawi at the Royal United Services Institute in London.
It's going to be about taking care of Libya, avoiding situations worsening in secondary theaters like Tunisia. If Chad gets into trouble because it's fragilized by the Sudan war, you would be able to just assume that Turkey and Egypt are roughly on the same side. Same thing with Sudan. You could, you know, you don't have the knee-jerk reaction of always being against the other.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has signed tens of billions of dollars in contracts with the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, both allies of Egypt. Analysts say such deals will help ensure the future of Turkey and Egypt's new rapprochement, and with it, the removal of a destabilizing force in the regions. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Zambia's national women's football team will make its World Cup debut Saturday against Japan at the matches in Australia and New Zealand. As Kathy Short reports, the national team's success has encouraged many young women to take up the sport. But Zambia's Football Association is also investigating allegations of sexual abuse by coaches.
There was a thunderous welcome for the Zambian national women's soccer team, popularly known as the Copper Queens, on arrival in New Zealand for their maiden appearance at the Women's World Cup. It's a dream come true for the team, as the supporters all over Zambia and beyond are in a jubilant mood to support them. Most of the players on the team come from low-income households. The Copper Queens' success has inspired many girls to take up football in a country where the sport has been dominated by men for a long time. Barbara Banda, Zambia's national women's soccer team captain, says in a WhatsApp message to VOA from New Zealand on Thursday that her journey as a professional female footballer was not an easy one. The 23-year-old plays professional football for the Chinese team Shanghai Shengli. Banda was ruled out of last year's Women's Africa Cup of Nations after she failed a gender eligibility test due to high testosterone levels. She is Zambia's first female footballer to play at the professional level.
I started from an academy. It's called Galax.
I used to play with the boys' team. I had some difficulties with my family and the parents because they really wanted me to concentrate much at school, but they always tell me, no, you can't be playing football, it's for boys.
But the team's participation at the World Cup has been embroiled in controversy over alleged sexual abuse of female players by some coaches. According to recent British media reports, some players were quoted as saying that it's normal for coaches to demand for sexual favors from the players. Football Association of Zambia spokesperson Sydney Mungala told VOA Thursday that the allegations are not new and the association has dealt with them. Mungala adds that the matter has been submitted to the International Association Football Federation, FIFA, which also conducted independent investigations.
The Football Association of Zambia did indicate that they had conducted an internal inquiry. They had also handed over the matter to the police because some of the allegations were of a criminal nature. We just want the Zambian public to actually rally behind the team. This is a glorious moment for Zambia, and we are not going to allow anyone to spoil it.
Zambia is also one of the few countries implementing equal pay for both female and male players. The Zambia Union of Football and Allied Workers Union is working closely with the Football Association of Zambia to ensure fair working conditions and contracts for female footballers and wants all players unionized. Like Chibale, Juliet Chibuta, Executive Director of the Zambia National Women's Lobby, a non-governmental organization that champions gender equality, says equal pay for both male and female players is non-negotiable.
Female footballers should be paid the same as the male counterparts, because of the fact that the energy and also the training and also the pride that they bring to the country is the same that the males could bring if they went to the World Cup.
The Copper Queens are considered underdogs at the World Cup and are ranked 77 in the world by FIFA. But the team surprised Germany last week when they beat them 3-2 in an international friendly. 32 teams are competing in football's biggest prize and includes teams like England, the United States, Brazil, Ireland, and Canada. Only 4 African teams are participating: Zambia, Morocco, Nigeria, and South Africa. Kathy Short for VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Moldova is again at a critical inflection point, said U.S. Agency for International Development Administrator Samantha Power. There is monumental pressure and challenges stemming from Russia's interference and Russia's war on Ukraine. Indeed, for years, Russia has been undermining Moldova's government, backing separatist forces, and fomenting unrest with an eye towards installing a Moscow-friendly regime there, much as it has tried to do in Ukraine and Georgia. However, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February of last year, these efforts backfired spectacularly. According to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Russia's aggression against Ukraine is helping to consolidate Moldova's society in favor of EU integration and emancipation from Moscow. The last thing Russia wants to see is integration into Europe that the United States has backed Moldova to pursue, said Administrator Power.
Moldovans have shown incredible resilience in the face of Putin's aggression. They have generously hosted more than 100,000 Ukrainian refugees, more per capita than any other country in Europe, even as Vladimir Putin has limited their gas supplies and funded politicians who seek to keep Moldova firmly within Moscow's orbit.
Despite these challenges, President Maia Sandu is leading an extraordinary charge towards democratic reform, economic growth, and reorientation towards Western markets. And she is also pursuing with USAID support energy independence and diversification, said Administrator Power. Historically, Moldova has been dependent on the Russian economy. Nevertheless, in recent years, the European Union has been Moldova's main trading partner, supporting Moldovan goods and access to new markets, helping industries and businesses be more competitive, strengthening local governance, building that local society. Again, those checks and balances, no matter who the government is, checks and balances are necessary for us, and those institutions have been built with USAID support, said Administrator Power.
25 years ago, 2/3 of Moldovan exports went to Russia. Today, more than 2/3 of Moldova's exports go to Western markets, and that those trend lines are only going to continue, and that we hope with time is going to end the brain drain and draw many Moldovans back to Moldova to make their contributions back at home.
Freeing Moldova from the grip of Russian interference absolutely is something that USAID has contributed to and the United States contributed to, said Administrator Power. Ensuring that every Moldovan who grows up has the ability to find a livelihood and a life and the kind prosperity the people of Moldova deserve.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.